is 3450. I'm Joe Dobzinski. Today I have Professor Michael Bronski. He is a co-author of You Can Tell Just by Looking. He is the professor of the practice in activism and media in the studies of women, gender, and sexuality at Harvard University. He has written for four decades on LGBT in both mainstream and queer publication. And we'll be right back. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's got to be tough to write as long as you have, but I mean, you've seen so many changes. Do we still look for the changes yet to come, or is it getting to be kind of leveling out?
No, I think we always look for changes.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've been an activist of some sort since I was probably in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a liberal Catholic high school in New Jersey where we actually, quite amazing, people are amazed by this, right? We actually sort of got credit for going on civil rights marches in the mid-60s as long as we did a reflection paper. And I became part of Students for Democratic Society when I went to college, and I joined Gay Liberation in 1969, so I've been doing a lot of activism. And one thing, if I learned one thing, it's that, I don't want to put down Dan Savage's It Gets Better campaign, because I think it does some good work. But for me, the reality is that it doesn't get better. The reality, well, sometimes it doesn't get better at all, but depending on the people. But the reality is that people make it better. So when we're looking at changes, I think that as long as we have a world we live in that is not perfect, which will be always, we'll always have people who are doing some form of activism, and we'll always be looking for more and better changes. You know, I mean, the changes are all different.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be, you know, we certainly had fights in the gay and lesbian community that hopefully we'll never have to have again. You know, fights such as, you know, the criminalization of certain sexual acts, which the Supreme Court put a rest to in 2003 with Lawrence v. Texas. But there's, you know, I was just saying to somebody before, there are 29 states in America that actually have laws protecting LGBT, that's a different situation, lesbian, gay, bisexual people against discrimination. That's 29 out of 50. In the other states, you can actually be fired from your job, be not given housing, be kicked out of a restaurant, because you're gay or lesbian, and not have any recourse. You know, there are only 18 states that actually have laws protecting transgender people. You know, the ENDA, which is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would be a federal act that would protect gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, passed the Senate this year. The first time it's passed, I believe, since 1982 or something. It's never passed before, and it certainly is not going to pass the House. And it's not going to pass the House anytime soon.
Sure. I guess the thing is that I have, it seems that some political people, and I'm not naming names, but the political mainstream, suddenly wake up to the fact that this is a real subject. This is real, like the civil rights movement was.
Completely, yes.
Is that for real, or do you think some of that is political gain?
Well, I think the basis of your question is the political mainstream ever for real?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I don't want to diss it. I don't want to give it too much credit. Politics, you know, people have famously said politics is a game of the possible. You know, certainly when we see Senator Portman, whose gay son came out, deciding that he was for same-sex marriage, I think it's an authentic change. I think, you know, as much as I might disagree with Dick and Lynn Cheney about many things, you know, they now support same-sex marriage because their daughter, Mary, has married Heather Poe, her lover, and they have a child. We cannot say this about Liz Cheney, who has married Cheney's sister, who does not accept same-sex marriage. You know, so I think when people come on, you know, there's I think in American politics it's very, very easy, particularly for leftists or for activists, to take a cynical view and say, oh, they're just doing this because they're on the bandwagon. They're doing it to get elected. They're doing it, you know. And that's true for some people in some cases, right? I think that cynicism of the American political system, which we have to have because the system is deeply flawed, and unless you're cynical, if you just accept it, you'll go nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be some distance. You know, but I think too much cynicism leads to a dead end, right? So I do think that, you know, that there are some mainstream political figures who have been embracing gay and lesbian rights, and probably mostly for the right reason, and probably mostly because they are jumping on the bandwagon. And, you know, if jumping on the bandwagon without really believing it, and you pass a good law, that's not the worst thing in the world.
And I guess my only concern is because it's so flexible. You know, 4 years after an administration is over, you could actually turn back that law.
You can. You can. So what's interesting is that there are actually, I forget the number, I believe there are 6 states now that actually have some form of protection, and it varies state by state, some form of protection put in place as policy by a governor protecting LGBT people. You know, and we saw that Bobby Jindal, right, the woman that came before him, I forget her name, had one of these laws, and Bobby Jindal came in and he said, it's out. Right. So, I mean, much harder to do this with a constitutional amendment, or much harder to do it with a Supreme Court ruling.
Sure.
Like, I don't believe that I can't imagine we live in a country where anybody would rescind Brown versus Board of Education. Well, no, I do live in a country where I do believe that they could actually turn back Roe v. Wade.
Sure.
If they wanted to. You know, but I don't think they're going to turn back, you know, the Lawrence v. Texas, which said that, you know, consenting that in fact homosexual acts in private between two people were constitutionally protected. So that was a fight people had. People won. It was a long, bitter fight that gay activists fought, and we have that, and I don't think that that's going to change. But there's so much else to change. I don't ever want people to rest by saying, you know, 15 states now have same-sex marriage. The other ones are coming along quickly. Probably true, although not Oklahoma, Mississippi, or Tennessee, I bet. But
sure.
But they will eventually, right? I mean, the DOMA decision this past summer was certainly a decision that knocked down a lot of barriers to different policies. But, you know, there are people, and actually Jonathan Rauch, who's a conservative, openly gay conservative commentator in Time magazine last week, pretty much said, we've won the same-sex marriage fight, the movement's over, there's no need to do anything else. You know, clearly, I think that is completely wrong.
Sure. As we were just talking about, they could change the law.
They could.
To make a change.
They could. And there's so much more to do.
You mentioned some of the states that are considered in the Bible Belt.
Mm-hmm.
How does religion play into this? I mean, some religions are turning a little bit. Other ones are getting hardcore.
Are getting hardcore. You know, and it's complicated, right? Because people,
sure.
There's a myth that's in the book, right, which is all religions condemn homosexuality. And Anne Pellegrini, who co-wrote the book, right, is a professor of religion at NYU and has written on this extensively, although we all worked on the myth itself because we each wrote a first draft and then mm-hmm. we collaborated. You know, and she said, well, first of all religions don't condemn homosexuality. Actually, it's absurd to even say this. You know, when we... Buddhism and Hinduism, Zoroastrianism have, you know, in fact, Buddhism disapproves of many forms of sexuality per se, including heterosexual behaviors. So it doesn't condemn homosexuality in any case. When we're talking about all religions condemn homosexuality, which is a position that usually American Christian, rather conservative Protestant churches put out, they're really talking actually about American conservative Protestant churches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even that's not true. If you include the Quakers and the Unitarians, I mean, the Quakers published a pamphlet in 1966 suggesting that same-sex marriage be allowed within the church. The Unitarians have been at the forefront. You know, the Episcopalians are having a bit of a schism about this,
sure.
But the church is completely divided. You know, Methodists and Presbyterians are having very active discussions within their congregations, within their polity, right, to change that. So, are the Southern Baptist Convention going to change soon? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but what's really interesting, right, is that when we say religion, what do we mean? So take Roman Catholicism, which I was raised as a Roman Catholic, right? So this is interesting, right, because certainly the bishops in America take very strong stance against same-sex marriage. The Pope recently has sort of said, just lay off it for a while because we are, like, pushing something that's not really even worthwhile pushing. But when you look at polling for the American Catholic, state by state, depending upon the state, right? So in New Jersey, which now has same-sex marriage, right? 5 years ago, like 64% of New Jersey Catholics who went to church supported same-sex marriage, despite the governor, despite the bishops, despite, at that point, the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the religion? Is in fact, the religion people who go to church and sit in the pews and give money every week, or is the religion the bishop who says certain things? Is the religion the pastor? Is the religion the Episcopalian synod at Lambeth? You know.
And I think one of the things that, you know, history has shown us that it's It's not a modern day mentality. It goes back even further. There are, you know, leaders and people that were great people of the world that had some kind of an experience, bisexual or they were gay or whatever the case may be. And up until now, or until recently, I shouldn't say today, but that was hidden. I mean, that wasn't discussed. I mean, and even I've heard that some of the books that talked about such things were either disposed of or rewrote.
Yes. Yeah. So one of the myths is in the book, and as I think I said earlier, right, that we tried to actually look at the homophobic myths and look at myths that the gay community holds among itself. You know, one myth that the gay community likes to, or people, organizations put it out in print, right, is that 10% of the people in the world are gay. It's a number that's taken from the 1948 Kinsey Report on Human Male Sexuality, which is what Kinsey actually said. Let me get this right. It said was that 10% of all American men he interviewed between the ages of 16 and 32 were exclusively homosexual, by which he meant having only homosexual sex, for 3 years of their lives. So that's not a 10% number for everybody.
Right.
I mean, but then again, you know, when you ask the question, well, how many people are gay, right? Then we have to ask the question, what do you mean by gay? Do you mean people who actually have physical homosexual sex? Do you mean people who have homosexual imaginations? Do we mean people who have incredibly vivid homosexual imaginations but never have sex? Do we mean people who have sex and identify as heterosexual? So sexuality is just very, very, I mean, we all know this, although people rarely say it, right? Sexuality itself is extremely complicated. It's complicated for gay people, straight people, everybody.
Sure. It has so many different angles.
Sure.
The thing that was interesting is, you know, I would say probably 6 months ago, there was a big thing on the news and hit the national news, stuff like that, about a church somewhere in this country that would magically turn you from a homosexual into a normal human being.
Right.
In their mind. That's incredible that people actually were going there thinking that was going to happen.
Sure. But people, you know, I mean, I think this is a perfect example of a complex situation about sexuality, right? So we have to ask the question, I mean, does this happen? Probably not. But sexuality is complicated. I mean, let's just say conjuring this up out of nothing. Let's just say this church is in Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
not to pick on Tennessee. It could have been anywhere else, actually, right? And you have somebody in Tennessee who has a man who has homosexual desires, and because of the culture, tells him to feel really badly about this. He actually will go to the church. Can the church magically do this through exorcism or through laying on of hands? An unfortunate phrase in this situation, perhaps. Well, of course not. That's not how human sexuality or human emotions work, right? Might he feel better for going? He may, you know, but that's because we live in a homophobic world. If the world was not homophobic, he may feel perfectly fine about his desires.
Do you think the advantage of technology and the internet and things like that have helped improve the situation?
Yes, completely. I mean, I would say yes and maybe no, but yes, completely. You know, I know when I teach at Dartmouth College, I taught there for years. I'm at Harvard now, but I taught at Dartmouth College for years. And I believe it was 2007 or 2008. It was the first year that an incoming freshman class showed up. And because the internet was widespread and because Facebook had manifested itself, you know, and everybody in high school was on Facebook, right? That for the first time in the history of the college, because Facebook never existed before, right? For the first time, I would say about 30 lesbians and gay men showed up as first day freshmen, and they all knew each other as gay and lesbian. They were out in high school, they came after each other on Facebook. So you immediately had a group of 30 students who bonded around an issue immediately without waiting until mm-hmm. who came out when, and it wasn't happening until January, right? So, technology in terms of getting the word out, in terms of getting out other ideas about people, in terms of, you know, getting out information. But also, let's be realistic here, right? The two downsides is that I'm told that the internet's filled with misinformation.
Sure.
It is riddled with misinformation. It is riddled with wrong information. It's riddled with really horrible information too, right? Really homophobic information and racist information and, you know, just appalling misogynist information, right? So the proliferation of content, of ideas, is terrific when it's accurate. It's not so good when it's bad. You know, you can certainly spread rumors about people. You can certainly, you know, look at cyberbullying.
Sure.
You know, I mean, that's really the downside of the people coming together. The other thing, if we look at political activism, because I'm somebody who grew up in civil rights movement and then in gay liberation, you know, where you literally had a poster, send people posters, you had what was called a phone tree, right? Where one person would call three people, those two people would call three people, those three people would call three people to get the word out about a meeting. You know, now, and my students are just amazed. They say, how do you do this? Now we just like email out. You know, and it's true. Emailing out about a rally or a meeting is far more efficient than making phone calls. The downside of that, right, is that if you made phone calls, you all knew each other. You knew the person's voice and their name. You probably knew what they looked like. There was a personal connection. You know, now we all, I'm presuming everybody on this show is in, we all get so many emails, so much information. We're deluged by things. Yeah. One more email about a meeting to go to might simply get lost. Okay. Also, I do think that what I call the sort of Facebook phenomenon, which is the I like that. You know, I mean, certainly what we saw with the fight this past summer about DOMA and the Supreme Court, right? People began to use the Human Rights Campaign equal sign, meaning equality, on all their Facebook pages, you know, which is great. You go onto Facebook and you see literally hundreds of thousands of people supporting this. You know, do they do anything else? Do they go to a rally? Do they send a letter? Do they call their congressman? Do they call their senator? I bet not. Dartmouth, I taught a class called Plagues in Politics about the AIDS epidemic. And we talked about ACT UP, the great AIDS advocacy group, right? And people, students were fascinated about ACT UP and how do they do this? How do they get people to meetings? And how do they get so much power? And somebody said, well, but this would be really easy to do today because we have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have Reddit, we can just get all this stuff out. And a freshman woman, she said, well, you know, what my fear is that you'd send out this notice saying, the community is being devastated by a horrible disease. We don't know what it is. It's killing gay men. We have to do something. And that 3,000 people would say, I like that. not that they liked AIDS, but that they actually liked somebody saying we should do something. Mm. Right. So, in fact, it's really easy now to feel that you're involved, to actually feel you made a commitment by pressing I like that. Versus going out into the streets and causing trouble.
Sure. One of the misconceptions I have read about is transgender and that it's a mental illness more than anything else.
Right.
Is that a true statement or is...
No, it's a false statement. Mm-hmm. And I am completely sympathetic that in fact, the very concept of transgender at this point in American history is complicated and foreign to people. I mean, things that are complicated and foreign to people are easy to make myths about,
mm-hmm.
You know. Transgender is, I mean, I would go actually to, I mean, so this is, again, complicated, right? It is not a mental illness. It is, you know, it is the reality that some people feel that they are in the wrong body, that they are actually the other gender, you know. The American Psychological Association has actually called it gender dysmorphia, which is not a mental illness, but they actually described it as a state of being. You know, I think the larger questions here about transgender experience, right, is for people to really begin to understand how complex gender and sexuality is. I mean, in some way, right, I mean, we say, oh, that's a transgender person. She must be, or he must be mentally ill. This is crazy. How do you think, because I had a student in class one time who said, I just, and she was very sincere. She said, I can't imagine thinking I was really a man. I said, well, no, because you're not transgender, but, you know. And she said, I don't understand it. And I said, well, you know, it's an experience that people have that is hard to communicate. I said, but I was raised Catholic, rather devoutly Catholic, and I'm not practicing now. But if I decided that I was actually a devout and practicing Buddhist, how did I know that? Did I, there's no telltale, you know, you don't like click, it doesn't happen, you know, it's an evolution. But also when we're looking at transgender people, you know, we say, oh, this person says she's transgendered, she's in this category. The reality is that gender is, and this is feminist theory, right, that gender is a construct. And there are certain ways to be a man, certain ways to be a woman that are idealized. And, you know, most people fall into some variation of that. But many people don't. Many people are on a continuum, you know, and also there's a myth that transgender people are actually homosexual, which is not true at all either. It's a completely separate phenomenon. But most people, I wouldn't say have male and female elements, but most people do not and cannot ever live up to the idealized man or the idealized female gender role. It's just impossible. One, because they're idealized and they don't exist. And two, because we have very complex relationships with gender, with our bodies, and with sex, you know, and certainly, you know, but this, you know, I mean, in many ways, and I'm not in any way implying Hillary Clinton is transgendered or a lesbian, right? But Hillary Clinton manifests many affects and many ways of living in her career that people have identified as too masculine, right? And they've called her, you know, mannish. She's a ball buster. She's a bitch. She's, you know, and worse. You know, I mean, Hillary Clinton has never tried to be that ideal woman. And again, I'm not saying that she's transgender, but I'm just saying that it might do everybody a little bit of good to really think about their own lives and really think about themselves and really think about how, in fact, they fit into a gender continuum. And they probably are somewhere in the middle of it.
Got a few minutes left in the show. What is the major misconception that you see for the LGBT community?
It's a tough question. From the straight community or within the community. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the community. You know, I think it's sort of amazing and appalling, right? I think one of the major myths against mostly gay men, but lesbians as well, is that and bisexuals, that gay people, I'll reduce them all to one category, that gay people are in some regard predetermined or predilected to molest children. We simply know this is not the case. We simply know it is most molestation of children happen within heterosexual households, usually, if not by, unfortunately, parents, by uncles, by neighbors, by cousins, by neighbors, you know. And yet this myth persists. You know, it really is a deeply felt myth. And we see it happen all the time. We see it happen. But it happens. So these days, people don't say all men are pedophiles. That comes up a little bit, right? But they're more likely to say, well, do I really want a lesbian teaching, an open lesbian teaching a second grade class? Do I really want this gay man, you know, perfect example, as a Boy Scout master? It's like, I mean, why wouldn't you? If you don't want that, that's probably because you think he will actually molest the boys, which means you've gone back to the oldest myth about gay people, which is that they're child molesters. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's very interesting, right, is that this as a myth that not just about gay people, but we see from early Middle Ages on, right, that whenever there was an outside group, and I'm thinking particularly of Jews in Europe, right, an outside group that you wanted to demonize, you would accuse them of child molestation, right? So there's a long history in Europe of Jews sexually molesting and then killing Christian children. Completely untrue. They did not kill Christian children and make matzah out of their blood. And yet what's so potent, right, is that you actually say this outside group, which we don't understand, we don't like, we don't want, are actually hurting the most innocent people in our mainstream group, who would be children. It's a highly effective way to demonize people. And even though we've been through this, and we've been through it again and again, and we have statistics showing that is not the case, we have statistics showing that actually who is doing it is actually heterosexuals, the myth persists.
Very enlightenment. Professor Michael Bronski has been our guest today. His book that he co-authored, You Can Tell Them Just by Looking, and 20 Other Myths About LGBT Life and People. if you want to know the truth about things and rethink yourself and how you look at things in the world, I suggest you pick up Michael's book. I think it'll be an eye-opener for you in a lot of different things.